Back to the Pearl Jam. No more hip hop this week. You decided to go back to the Pearl Jam?
You gotta go with what works, man.
It's been working pretty well. Although I did like when we went with the hip hop. That was pretty cool. That was a change of pace. Next week.
You know, if you behave yourself, maybe we'll go back to hip hop next week.
Next week, we have the Billboard. Speaking of which, this week we have a new segment at 8:20. Danielle Shumaleski, I think, I don't know if I pronounced her name right, but Danielle Shumaleski something, calling in from Billboard magazine. She's going to tell us about the top 5 or 6 songs in the Billboard charts. This is Tom Kramer. This is a show called Speaking Of, a show where we talk to lots of interesting people, including actors, authors, business people, politicians, anyone who's seemingly interesting and got an interesting story to tell. Brought to you by First State Orthopedics. First State Orthopedics is Delaware's largest orthopedic practice. 23 specialized surgeons along with 16 nurse practitioners and physician assistants. They're dedicated to providing patients with the best care possible using the latest in surgical and non-surgical treatment methods. Their goal is to help patients resume an active lifestyle after an injury or disorder to the shoulder, hand, elbow, hip, knee, foot, ankle, spine, anywhere, 13 convenient locations. There's a place for you. Visit them on the web at firststateortho.com. It's a great place. You should check them out. They're all throughout Delaware. Also, Eagle Eye Ticket Management. I've been doing business with Eagle Eye for years, and if you need tickets to any concerts, sporting events, or theater anywhere in the country, they're your best source, period. Prices are incredible, and they get tickets to sold-out events like the Masters, the Super Bowl, many concerts. Ryan, I know you're a concert guy. You have to check these guys out as well. No additional taxes or service fees. Call Eagle Eye at 484-841-6840. That's 484-841-6840. Before we start, big win for the Giants this week over the Patriots, huh?
Every win's a big win.
I think I should start to maybe not talk as much about the Eagles and maybe start to prop you up a little bit.
Yeah, after they lost to the Jets, I probably wouldn't say much.
No, that was horrible. But it's preseason, so who cares, right?
It's over with now.
What do we have, Game 3, our bets for Game 3 this year? Giants-Eagles? I think it's at the Eagles, so I'll take the Giants. One of our guests, I think, may be a Giants fan. Speaking of which, today I'm very pleased to have two guests in the studio. Not one, but two. We're going to talk about sports psychology, coaching, triathlon, endurance sports, marathons. If you ever thought about running a marathon or doing a triathlon, then you want to stay tuned and listen to this show. We have Dr. Mitch Green, who is a leading licensed clinical and sports psychologist. He writes articles and delivers workshops and presentations to schools and organizations such as USA Squash, USA Triathlon, Episcopal Academy. He's a frequent contributor to blogs and radio interviews, and his articles can be read in numerous magazines and online publications. We also have joining us Bill Hauser, who's been active in endurance sports both as a coach and a competitor for more than 20 years. Bill's a select number of coaches in the United States to have received the Level 2 certification by USA Triathlon, the national governing body of the sport. He's also a USAT-certified youth and junior coach, and he serves as the head triathlon coach for the South Jersey Triathlon, or the South Jersey chapter of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society training program. And he's completed the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii 3 times. That's the triathlon that you see on NBC every year around Christmas time. And he's run nearly 20 marathons around the world. He's gone 242 in a marathon. Now, just to give you an idea, the winners of marathons probably go, Bill, about 206 or 210. So that's quite an impressive time. And he's gone 9 hours and 38 minutes in the Ironman, which is probably top 100 Americans or something like that. So pretty fast. So, guys, thanks for being here today. A lot to talk about. A lot of questions for both of you. It's 8:05. If you want to ask a question, 888-329-3306. 888-329-3306, WWDB 860 AM. Let's start with you, Mitch, hot into it right out of the gate. Tell us a little bit about where you're from, just your general background.
Sure. I'm originally a New Yorker, so yes, a Giants fan. And I came down to Philadelphia.
Thanks for coming, Mitch. We appreciate it. Bill, tell us a little bit about you. No, just kidding.
I came to Philly for graduate school and kind of never left. And I got into sports psychology actually about 10 years after I even graduated from my PhD program. When I was in graduate school, there really wasn't much talk about sports psych, but I was somebody who was watching the news and reading the New York papers, where I saw a New York Yankee player named Chuck Knoblauch go through a complete mental block that prevented him from being able to throw the ball from second to first accurately. And it was only a few years after Knoblauch had that problem that he was literally out of the league. He went from a league MVP to out of the league in a matter of 4 or 5 years. And so that always stuck with me. And then later on in my career, I decided to jump into sports psych, and the rest is history.
Bill, your background is pretty interesting because you were actually completely different. You took a totally different path after school. You went to law school, and you became a lawyer. And then maybe too much of the admiration of many people listening, you decided to get out of the law. Went a completely different path and decided to become a triathlon coach. But are you originally from the area as well?
That's correct. I grew up in the Philadelphia area, lifelong resident and Eagles fan.
You can stay.
I went to college at Drexel University and law school at Villanova, so stayed local for school as well, but have been active in endurance sports my whole life. I swam on a swim team for 10 years when I was younger, and then got really into running and then distance running. And after practicing law for several years, I realized that really was not my passion. I had always wanted to start my own business, and kind of with no grand plan, kind of transitioned into the world of endurance sports, and I've been doing it now with Mid-Atlantic Multisport for over 15 years. So
just in the area, or you can do a lot virtually as well. So you all over the country, can you coach people anywhere, or do they have to be physically in Philadelphia?
I do. They can be anywhere. I've actually coached athletes all around the world. Singapore, I have an athlete in Beijing right now who is actually doing the Beijing triathlon this weekend. But I would say the majority of the athletes I work with are in the Mid-Atlantic region, but certainly I do work with athletes, you know, across the country and around the world.
Right. So we're going to talk about online coaching and how that's maybe changed your world as well in terms of coaching, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Mitch, what specifically does a sports psychologist do? Now, I have the benefit of knowing what a regular psychologist does, maybe too much. Although my psychologist moved once and never told me they moved. I just showed up one day and they had moved. So that was I've never been back. So that was a whole nother story. But what exactly does a sports psychologist do as compared to maybe a regular therapist?
Yeah. So I happen to be both a regular therapist and a sports psychologist. And there's probably two main areas that a sports psychologist could focus on. It could be about performance, helping Bill's athletes get ready for a triathlon, get ready for a race, manage their nerves, help them build confidence, help them get kind of a mental game plan. And then the other side of sort of sports psychology is a little more clinical. It's helping people who may have a mental health issue and they're also an athlete. How do they manage their mental, you know, a real diagnosable level of depression or anxiety? And helping them sort of take care of that part of their life so that they can get back onto the field, get back into sports.
Have you ever worked with anyone from high school? Because you work with a lot of high school students as well, right through adulthood.
I have.
And do they typically do that? Is there a lot of change that occurs from there's a lot of difference between a high school athlete and an adult athlete, right?
There are a lot of peaks and valleys, and I sort of try to be there for them through it all. You know, some of these high school athletes that I work with are aiming to get recruited and get recruited and perform at a very high level in school and on the field. And some of them have decided to go pro after their college, a small select number that I work with. And you leave the college environment where the structure of your coaches telling you when to show up to practice. You sit and eat lunch with all your buddies and all your teammates every day, and then they turn pro, and it's a whole different world. You're not winning all the time, and there's no one to provide the structure for
you. The pressure that young athletes face these days, and I mean this is really to both of you, is seemingly much more prevalent than it maybe was, I don't know, you tell me, but 10 or 15 years ago. The pressure to perform, even at an amateur level, Bill, is it seems like the competition is tougher. There's more people even doing performance-enhancing drugs. It's a lot more stressful. I mean, do you notice a difference in stress levels among competitive amateur athletes now as to where there was maybe 10 years ago, or is there no difference? I mean, and one reason, by the way, I say that is you read so much more about amateur athletes taking performance-enhancing drugs, which to me is absolutely amazing that there's that much of a need to be successful in the amateur ranks.
Now, I think it certainly exists out there, and Mitch can probably speak to the team sport environment better than me, where, you know, I know it exists. In terms of the endurance sports world where I work, by and large, the people I'm working with are people that are college age and above. So it's not so much in the youth world. There is a huge youth triathlon movement, and you know, there are many kids getting into the sport, and that is very competitive. But in the age group ranks with athletes, it right. certainly has become more competitive. And as you said, I mean, there are now stories you hear of age group athletes taking performance-enhancing drugs because they want to do things like compete on the national team, race in the Ironman World Championship, run the Boston Marathon, and events like that where you need to qualify to get in to them. Sadly enough, there's people out there that will do anything, whether it's cutting a course or taking drugs. So
it's amazing to me the amount of people that you read about if you follow the sport, not weekly, but certainly monthly, who have been banned from the sport or who basically get caught for cheating. And I mean, we're amateurs. We're doing this for fun. You know, you're going to tell me that you're going to risk your safety by taking a performance enhancing drug just so you can go to a race and get a medal, because ultimately that's what we get as a medal. You don't win any money. You know, it's all for bragging rights, which Mitch is interesting because there's that much more pressure, it seems like, on people and especially on younger people to perform.
Yeah.
I mean, now, you know, with scholarships and frankly with the rising cost of college tuition, scholarships are even that much more appealing. And you hear parents that become what I call deck parents in swimming, where they're on the deck and they're pushing their kids to get, you know, that scholarship. And I'm curious to know if you see a lot more competitive nature in things like squash and triathlon and tennis.
I see it across the board. Yeah, the cover of Time magazine this week is about youth sports, and it's a $1 billion business. Just the world of sports travel is a $1 billion business. The hotels, the places, the performance centers that have been created to help house some of these youth sport teams. It is a totally different world, and parents are involved at a totally different level than they ever were. At least when we were growing up playing sports, parents are at practices more than they ever have been, let alone being at the games and tournaments. So yes, the kids that I see and the athletes that I work with, the younger ones, are sometimes getting pressure from their parents, but people might be surprised to hear these are lots of kids who are putting a lot of just pressure on themselves. They come from a high performing type of family. They feel like they have to live up to a certain expectation, and social media makes it all the more difficult. It's one thing to run a race and know that you ran a certain time in it, but now you can go online and see what your competitor
right.
across the state or across the country did, and all of a sudden it's like a different game that these kids
are playing. It's almost like in real time.
It's like in
so everything's happening a lot faster with social media. You know, you get your results emailed to you right away, and then you put even more pressure on yourself and
that's right.
and so forth. Interesting question, Bill. Do you have to like the person? I better be careful with this because, in full disclosure, you're my coach. Do you have to like the person you coach?
Yeah.
I don't know that you have to. Certainly it helps. I can say that I've had the good fortune – you know, in all the years that I have been coaching, I have liked most of the athletes I've coached. There's a couple difficult personalities I've had with over the year, but I've been extremely lucky, and it's actually one of the biggest differences I found between when I was practicing law to when I got into coaching. And one of the things I actually love the most about my job is when I was practicing law, by and large, when someone's meeting with a lawyer, they're meeting with that person because they have to, not because they
right.
want
not
to.
Not because they
want
to go in and say hi to their lawyer
right.
at $700 an hour.
As a triathlon coach, I'm working with people who are doing something. It's their passion. It's something they enjoy doing. So people
right.
like talking to me about what they're doing. So it's an entirely different dynamic than it was when I was practicing law. So I just think because of that, it's a much easier type of relationship to have.
Well, one of the things I like about you, some coaches I've seen online will only let you email or talk to them once or twice a month. But you're sort of to within as long as people respect it, you're within boundaries that people can contact you at any time. So I think that's a nice thing too. Whenever you call your lawyer, you got to pay every time you pick up the phone to call the lawyer, which is expensive to do in and of itself. I want to go back to something that you brought up before, which is youth in triathlon and that it's getting bigger and bigger. Why is it that you think we don't have a big inner city following with triathlon? And is there any movement to get more inner city kids involved in triathlon? And by the way, I think part of it's probably training. You can't ride your bike in the city as easily as you can in the suburbs. But I'm just curious to know why it doesn't seem like all of the sports out there that there's a big push for inner city triathletes.
Right. Well, that's a good question. I think there probably are a few reasons. One is, as you say, in terms of getting out and riding, a little more difficult if you live in an urban environment than if you're out on where you have, you know, neighborhoods and open roads where you're able to ride and not have the traffic concerns that you may living in a city. Triathlon also is not an inexpensive sport to participate in terms of equipment. So, you know, bicycle, it costs money, and to have access to a pool, that's not something everyone has the ability to do. So I think there's challenges in that sense, but there are programs to get more inner city kids involved in the sport. I know there's a Caden Cycling Foundation, which has done a great job in getting kids involved in the sport and providing them with equipment to get them involved. So there is a movement, but it's certainly happening slowly.
I read, I think I did some research before the show, and I read where the average demographic of a triathlete is astounding. It's like, oh, well over $100,000 or something like that, $120,000. I mean, the bikes are, you know, anywhere, you know, $2,000 up to countless money you could spend on a bike, and memberships to gyms and memberships to pools, and even buying a pool for your house. There's endless pools where you can pool that you can fit in. It's like a treadmill for water and things like that. Mitch, adult athletes that you work with struggle with a lot of things. One of them is just finding the time, and then time puts pressure on you, getting in the workouts, competitiveness with other adults, and then the type A personalities bring up. What are some of the most common things that you see the adult athletes that you struggle with? Common things that maybe someone thinks right now they're struggling with that maybe isn't just particular to them. It's more of a common theme that you see across the board.
I would say one of the most common themes is lack of confidence. If we just stick to the endurance sport world, somebody does a short triathlon or a short road race, and then they want to move up because they are excited to train a little bit more and kind of reach for a new goal. And in the process of making it more competitive for them, making it more challenging for them, they get scared and they get nervous that after all that hard work, they won't be able to finish the race they want to finish. They won't be able to do it in a time that they want to. And so my job is to sort of help them talk about and normalize some of the anxiety, the nerves, the jitters that go along with sort of trying to get them to reach for a goal that's out of their comfort zone. And that's really a big part of what I do, is I try to get them, first of all, to see that it's just nerves, and it's sort of a part of the competition picture, not a sign that there's something wrong with them. And so, and in order to kind of experience life at its fullest, we have to get out of our comfort zone, and the athletes know that I see. But as they move through the process, they get nervous and tense and start to think there's something wrong. They lose confidence. And
it's funny because a lot of the things I hear you talk about can translate into life itself.
Yeah.
It's not just sports, but it's getting out of your comfort zone in general is not a bad thing to do in life itself. So there's a lot of parallels, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Right now, I want to take a couple-minute break and talk to Danielle Chmielewski, who is with Billboard, or is going to talk to us about Billboard and about some of the top songs being played out there right now. New segment for us at 8:20 on WWDB 860 AM. Danielle, how are you?
Good. How are you?
In full disclosure, did I butcher your last name?
No.
Okay, perfect.
You did a really good job.
We know each other from another station, which we won't mention the call letters of, but this is our first time on WWDB. Appreciate it. You're going to come in the studio with us and visit with us a couple times as well, maybe down the line next month or something like that. But where do you want to start today? What do you want to start with? Want to start with pop?
Yeah, let's start with the hot, let's just go with the Hot 100 song.
Okay. Ryan, overall. You ready? We got Ryan on the board. He's going to help us out a little bit. So we'll take, we got about 8 minutes, 9 minutes. So we'll get into it. Let's start with the top. Okay.
All right. Cool. So we're going to start with number 5 and work our way up to number 1. There are some changes this week. One song I have not heard of before. So we'll get there. Number 5 is Attention by Charlie Puth.
Attention. Yep. We're with you.
Yeah, he's 25 years old and pretty much killing it right now. So
I actually know who this guy is. That's how hip I am for my age. Ryan, do you know who this guy is?
Of course I do. He had that hot song last year for the Fast and Furious soundtrack.
Chime in on this session whenever you want. Okay, Ryan knows. He's going to help us out.
Yep.
Number 4.
Yeah, he wrote that song for Paul Walker, I believe.
Paul Walker, who died in the Fast and the Furious, or who died in the... Not in the movie, but outside of the movie. Yep. Number 4.
All right. Number 4 is Believer by Imagine Dragons.
I know Imagine Dragons out of Las Vegas, Nevada. Had a lot of hits.
Yeah, we have heard them a lot on the charts these days. Number 3 is Bodak Yellow, Money Moves by Cardi B.
You don't
Cardi
like them,
B.
Ryan? No. Not a big
This is
big
the one
fan.
I haven't heard before.
Trust me on this one. You are not missing anything by not hearing this song. But yeah,
Ryan also goes by the name of DJ Lennox, so he's actually truly a great DJ. So this is new to the charts.
Oh
this
yeah.
Week? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, and that does not sound like I would like it very much.
Nope.
No, it didn't make the cut with us. All right.
No. Number 2 is Wild Thoughts by DJ Khaled featuring Rihanna and Bryson Tiller.
We know DJ Khaled. We know Rihanna.
So you hear the sample that they're using?
Yeah.
Santana? From like 15 years ago? Yeah.
The guitar sample in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know what that means? They had to share a lot of the profits of the song with Santana. I immediately think of the business aspect of this. That's like these bands with 10
Santana
people.
Yeah, Santana
made
out well with that song.
You know, like bands with tons of people in it. Don't have so many people in your band. You got to split up the profits too many ways. Word to young musicians. I have musicians come in here. Had a guy in here a month ago. He's got 8 people in the band. The guy lives in New York. He's making about $2 a day. Less people make more money. All right, we're down to number 1.
Just write the song yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Our number 1 song on the Hot 100 charts for the week is Despacito by Luis Fonsi, Daddy Yankee, and our favorite Justin Bieber.
The Biebs. Cut his concert tour short. Canceled the rest of his dates. See, I know what's going on.
I heard this song over the weekend, and it has been stuck in my head ever since. What's today? Wednesday? And it's still in my head.
Well, Ryan, you play this song?
Every wedding, every event, play the Justin Bieber Despacito 50 times. They want it on repeat. I'm like, no.
play it on the loop. Just put it on the loop and tell them to give you a check. All right, let's see.
Yeah, that's when you say, sorry.
We got time for another chart. So what else do you want to hit?
All right, let's hit the rock songs for the week.
Rock songs, okay.
Top rock songs.
So Ryan said the same thing, so we'll do rock.
Actually, so before, this is a fun fact, before we get to the rock songs, I'm gonna talk pop for a second. So, you know, Made in America was this weekend in Philadelphia, and, Jay-Z was here, and Beyonce was obviously here. So, there's a little bakery called, The Cake Life.
Yep.
And they are, maybe 3 blocks from my house where I live, and they made the cake for Beyonce's birthday this weekend. So I thought that was a pretty fun fact.
That's pretty cool. They could probably charge whatever they want to charge, too. There's one guy who's not going to ask you about the price. You just, how much is a cake? Cake's $10 million. Okay. I'll give you $10 million for the cake. Anything for the cake. All right, so let's get to the rock. We have about 3 minutes left. My guests are riveted by the I can tell by the top. They know every song in this chart. You guys know all the songs in the charts?
No.
Me neither.
All right. Well, we'll get back to them in a minute. Don't worry about them, Danielle.
Our number five is Numb by Linkin Park.
Number five is this song. Oh, because Chester probably just put this back in the charts.
Yeah, I feel like we're sitting in the 90s here on our rock.
Yeah, that's actually pretty amazing that the death of somebody like that can catapult a song right back up into the top five. It's a great song.
Yeah.
This used to be our theme song for the show. And number four?
Our number four song is Wish I Knew You by The Revivalists. They're actually on tour right now. They're going to be in Philly in November.
You know these guys, Ryan?
Yeah, they play them on the other station I listen to.
Which is it? A Beasley Media station?
No. Okay. They're on 104.5. I listen to them all the time.
I actually know this song as well, so they're great.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
And they're on tour.
Our number three. Yeah, they are on tour. Our number three song is Thunder by Imagine Dragons. They're up here twice. So they're really killing it. I'm actually not a huge fan of Imagine Dragons, but you know.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of their story. They all lived in a house together in Las Vegas, and they played casinos, and they made it on their own. So the story's actually pretty interesting.
Hmm.
All right, let's keep going. We'll wind down.
And our
here.
Number two song is "Feel It Still" by Portugal the Man. I read an interesting fact about them recently too. This song, which is their biggest hit so far, they wrote it in under an hour.
Wow. Well, a lot of these, we interview a lot of singer-songwriters, and some of them will tell you that their best song is coming like 20 minutes in the shower or 10 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
Where they just bang them out quickly. Some of the greatest hits ever written have been banged out in like 10 or 15 minutes. Others take over a year. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. And our number one song for the week on our rock charts is Believer by Imagine Dragons.
I know this song.
That's been there for a while.
Ryan, you good?
Yeah, I like it.
All right. DJ Lennox gives it to
I mean, everybody hypes them up because they're from Vegas, but I mean, they're not the killers, so.
No. All right, Danielle, we covered two charts, 828. We appreciate it. We're going to talk to you next week as well. Hopefully we'll get you in the studio in the next couple weeks as well.
I know. I hope to be there soon.
We'd like to get you in the studio for the whole show. We can talk about some music, get the charts going, and so forth and so on. So appreciate your calling in. We'll talk to you next week.
Yep, sounds good. See you later.
Okay, thanks. The WWDB 860 AM, Tom Kramer here with Bill Hauser and Mitch Green talking about sports and sports psychology and coaching and everything involved around it. Mitch, I want to get back to something that we were talking about before the break, which is issues that athletes face, adult athletes, what they face, some common themes of people that you see. How important is visualization? Do you work with people on visualization? And this is probably a question to both of you, but I don't know how much, Bill, you talk to your clients about it. But I'm personally a big believer in visualization. I think that whether that's in business or in personal life or in sports, that if you envision the time you're going to do or what the finish line looks like and you keep thinking about that, then that's going to help you propel through the race.
Yeah, there's a saying, you have to see it in order to be it. And I use it as well. And so that's a big part of the work that I do as I help people get ready for whatever the competition is, endurance sport or not. And the other thing you do as part of visualization, without going into all the details, is you don't just visualize the finish line. You visualize the hard parts. You visualize in the world of triathlon when your chain pops off. You visualize a flat tire and how you're going to sort of stay calm and stay cool and handle it. Even the great Michael Phelps talks about he would visualize, you know, what would happen if his goggles came off, and it did, of course, in a particular race years ago, and he felt like he was prepared for it because he already been there, done it in practice. So, to me, the visualization, what I think about is not just about visualizing success, but handling the doubts, how you're going to handle the tough parts of a course if we stick to endurance sports. And I think without it, an athlete really isn't necessarily ready to go. And some of the great athletes just do it naturally. A lot of people do it naturally. And some people just need a little bit of help understanding exactly how to visualize in a way that's actually going to help them the most.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people visualize, but it's not necessarily a visualization, but they'll actually write down on a post-it, you know, if they're going to run a marathon, they'll say, you know, I am a 3-hour marathoner, and they'll put that post-it on their mirror in their bathroom, and they'll look at it every day, and that helps them get to that goal. Bill, does this come up much with your clients that you work with? Do you have people talk about visualization, or do you help them not only just in the training, but do you help them in the mental part of racing as well?
I do, and I was actually reassuring to hear Mitch's comments, because one of the things I do with my athletes is, you know, not only do I tell them to think about how they're going to feel on the course and feeling good, feeling strong out there, but also to kind of think through if things do go wrong, how they'll handle it. Whether if they do get a flat tire or their goggles get knocked off in the swim or something like that, or they're having GI issues, you know, how are they going to handle it? And I find that by doing that, if a person has spent some time thinking about it kind of in a, you know, a non-stressful, relaxed setting while they're at home, if one of those instances comes up during a race, they're going to be much more relaxed and able to deal with it in the moment.
Right. Bill, what type of athletes do you typically work with? You work with bikers, swimmers, triathletes? Do you ever work with just marathoners?
I do. It's actually a mix. I work with both single sport athletes, whether it's strictly a swimmer or a runner, someone training for their first 5K or 10K or marathon, and triathletes, people who are competing in triathlons where they're swimming, biking, and running. And in terms of ability levels, I work with athletes who are maybe training for their first race. They're training for their first 5K run, up to elite level athletes who are training for, you know, a world championship triathlon or to run the Boston Marathon or some sort of championship event. So it's really a wide range of athletes, which is another thing I like about the job.
And what fears do people, do you think, have going into their first marathon and or triathlon? Is there a common fear that people have? I know before I did my first triathlon, you know, you hear a lot of people say, I was afraid of the swim. I'm afraid of getting in the water with 100 to 1,000 people and getting kicked or drowning. And this is what Mitch works with people on as well. I mean, it's, you know, I'll share it here. I've been swimming for 40 years, probably 45 years. And all of a sudden, I developed this fear of deep water. I don't know where it came from. I think it came from a race I did, but I just couldn't imagine myself in deep water. And I, to the point where I was really didn't want to race. And Mitch will talk about that in a minute, help me through it. But, is there a common fear that you hear both in marathoning and or half marathoning and in triathlon?
Yes. Well, first with triathlon, I mean, certainly the swim aspect of it is probably one of the most common ones. I mean, you know, one of the things that makes triathlon unique is that for everyone doing their first race, you know, one or more of those disciplines are typically new for an athlete. You know, people will get into the sport, maybe they have a running background, they've done some running races before, or maybe they swam when they were younger and have some swimming experience. But, you know, at least one, if not two, of the disciplines are going to be relatively new for that individual. So I always kind of try to flip it around on them and kind of use that as a positive, because, you know, a lot of times people do have anxieties about entering a race. And, you know, what I always try to tell them is, you know, one of the nice things about the sport of triathlon is people will have their strengths and weaknesses. Someone may be a really good runner, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be a strong swimmer or a strong cyclist. So, you know, I find that kind of makes the sport a great equalizer, and it allows people to feel like, hey, you know what, I can do this, because not everyone, generally speaking, is going to be really strong at all three disciplines.
Right. But, yeah.
I was going to say, but I would say in terms of the things that cause anxiety for people in doing their first triathlon, certainly the swim is probably the most common, because even people that have swimming experience, most of the time it's swimming in a pool. So triathlons, most of the triathlons people are doing, the swim is going to be in open water, and that's an entirely different environment from being in a pool.
How do you practice, though? I mean, you know, how do you practice that then? How do you – I've heard people – one of the things I did just to tell people is I'll shut my eyes in a pool, and then I only open them when I breathe, and that gives me the sensation that I'm in dark water. Are there places people can go to practice open water swimming once they start working with you? How do you work with people in that environment to recreate that environment?
There are. There are some groups. Our company, we offer a whole series of open water skills and safety clinics and provide training swim opportunities for athletes out at Marsh Creek State Park in Downingtown. There's other organizations that offer similar things throughout the area. But for a lot of people, it is a challenge, because particularly if you live in Pennsylvania, it's not easy to find spots where open water swimming is allowed. If you're down by the Jersey Shore, you have more opportunity. But I encourage all athletes, you know, before doing their first triathlon, certainly, but even those with lots of experience, the more practice that you can get
right
swimming in open water, the better off you're going to be. Because the one of the biggest challenges with it, you know, swimming is swimming. Yes, there's certain skills that are applicable to open water swimming that you don't really need to deal with or concentrate on in a pool. Sighting, you know, staying.
I mean, it's a lot different than being in a pool.
It's very different.
And that's part of the apprehension, I think, is people just don't know what to expect.
That's exactly.
And that's,
right.
I mean, Mitch, I would ask you, how do you work with people when they come to you and say, I'm terrified, I don't know what to expect? One of the best pieces of advice you ever gave me, and maybe you want to talk about this, is you said to me, and I tell you this all the time, is you said, be curious. And it was two simple words, but it got me through some tough races. You just said, you know what, don't fear what's around the corner. Just mm-hmm. be curious. And I think if you tell yourself that during it, whether people are listening and they're going to do the Philadelphia Marathon or the Rock and Roll Marathon coming up in 2 weeks, that's some great advice.
Well, I'm glad it's been so helpful. The mind wants to quit before the body has to.
I had a lot
to.
Of things, by the way, that I'm a mental patient with, but that particular thing helped me a lot.
Yeah, well, that fits with the just the thinking for people out there, is that your mind is going to want to stop and quit and say, I've had enough, before you have to. And I'm not talking about if you're in actual physical pain or you have some sort of injury. I'm talking about just the toughness of a competitive pain, of a competitive race. And so, yeah, my job in many ways is to keep people's mind open and keep them focused. Without a real game plan going into a marathon or a triathlon, a mental game plan, people's minds then will close in on them and get that and let the doubt sort of take over. So with anybody I work with, we go through the fears and the doubts. I listen to them, and athletes often know what they shouldn't focus on, but they're often at a loss to know what they should focus on.
Right.
And so whether it's about being open-minded, whether it's about something related to their technique, we come up with a series of things that we think are going to help them in the race. We get them to practice them in practice, trying them out on hard workouts, so that come race day, they've got something to go to when the you-know-what hits the fan. And in any one of these races that Bill works with his athletes, my athletes, something's going to happen at some point, so you need to be ready.
Do you guys work together a lot? I mean, do you have a lot of mutual clients? Does one have to have a sports psychologist to perform well? Or, I mean, probably, obviously it helps, but do you work together closely with a lot of athletes?
We do work together, and I think one of the strengths of Bill is Bill's as much a good sports psychologist as he is a great triathlon coach. So good coaches are often good psychologists, really. And so, but there have been occasions where Bill and I have shared an athlete, or Bill will call me for a consult, or in situations where I've called Bill and I say, there's an aspect to this that I know is mental that I'm working on, but there's something's not adding up for me in the physical department in terms of how this athlete's performing. And in some cases, I've referred an athlete to eyeball and watch in the pool, actually, in this recent example. And that athlete came away with a new set of physical skills from Bill. And that was a perfect sort of marriage of our strengths.
Right.
Yeah, and it does. And it works both ways. And one of the things that I think is great about Mitch as a sports psychiatrist is he's also an athlete. He competes in endurance sports. He's run marathons. He's done Ironman triathlons. So, you know, not only does he know the sports psychology side of it, he also participates in those events. And I think that's really helpful because he can really understand the athletes, what their concerns are and what their needs are.
Tom Kramer on WWDB 860 AM. It's 8:41 on Wednesday morning. Bill, what type of, how much time does it take to train for a triathlon? Part of the problem, I think, is that people are so busy working, the adults, and they have lives and families and so forth. How long does it take to train? Can you get away with, you know, 8 hours a week, or is it 10 hours a week, or?
Well, a lot of it's going to depend on the type or distance triathlon that the individual is training for. A lot of people have a misconception about the sport of triathlon, and when they think of triathlon, they immediately think of the Ironman that you see, as you mentioned, on December on NBC. You know, that's an event where participants are swimming 2.4 miles, they're biking 112 miles, and then running a marathon. That is, which I should mention that you have completed, and I was there to watch across the finish line.
It completed me.
In Kona.
Somehow I got my medal.
But that's not the only distance that you can race in triathlon. They have sprint triathlons where you're swimming 400 meters, which is about a quarter mile. You're biking 10 to 12 miles and generally running 5K, 3 miles. So the amount of training time you need to prepare is going to be really dependent upon the race distance. And I have athletes who are training for shorter tries that are training on, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours a week. It's not something that you can't do and still have a life, a demanding job, and family commitments.
Which is probably as much as you would go to the gym anyway. So if you go 3 times a week for an hour, that's 3 hours or something like that. So it's not that much more. Take a break and talk to Donna Shore from Visit Philly, PA. Donna's on the phone, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what's happening this weekend for a few minutes. Donna, how are you? It's been a couple weeks. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm good, thanks. How are you, Tom?
Good, thanks for calling. What's happening this weekend?
Okay, well, as I always remind everybody, you can go to visitphilly.com or you wish you knew, U-W-I-S-H-U-N-U.com for more ideas. But I think the big news this week is that starting Thursday, we have our 21st year of our annual Fringe Festival. And that's hundreds of opportunities to check out dance, theater, music, comedy, and visual arts. So that'll run from this Thursday all the way to September 24th. You can find out more about it at fringearts.com, and that'll give you info on the guides and how to get tickets and et cetera. So if you're into food, though, this is a great week for food. Starting Thursday through the weekend, the Philadelphia Honey Festival. It's the 8th one they've had in the city, and it'll be talks and tastings and lots of fun for kids and their grown-ups at 3 historic sites. Glenford in the Delaware, Wick Historic House, and Bartram's Gardens. You can go to phillyhoneyfest.com for more details. And then if you're into mushrooms, we have a mushroom festival. It's become a very popular event this Saturday and Sunday in Kennett Square, considered the mushroom capital of the world. And you can go to mushroomfestival.org to find out more about that. But that's got tastings and music contests and even a car show. And if you're still into food, there's Center City Restaurant Week, which will kick off this Sunday at 120 eateries in the neighborhood. It's become a very popular thing to do. And some of the city's best eateries and all kinds of new places you may not have tried are going to have special $35 dinner deals, $35 dinner deals and $20 lunch deals. And to get more information about discounts for parking or for Lyft, you can go to www.centercityphila.org/restaurant week for all the good details about that. And just in the region this weekend is a chance for the last week and a half to see the Andrew Wyeth exhibit, which is on at the Brandywine River Museum until September 17th. So if you haven't seen that yet, that's a great thing to do. You can go to brandywine.org/museum to get more details on that.
Good. That's it.
And there's always more, but I didn't know how much time we were going to have.
Time for a couple more.
Okay, well, Spruce Street Harbor Park which is that wonderful outdoor playground on our Philadelphia waterfront, will be open till October 1st, and that's a great free experience. There's hammocks, lights, patio games, and food if you want to buy that, or draft beer even, if you're into a little cocktail and sitting by the water. And I think this rain's going to end, so I think by this weekend it'll be a wonderful place to hang out. And Longwood Gardens, which is one of my favorite places in the region, it's about an hour from Philadelphia, also in Kennett Square where the Mushroom Festival is, they still have their illuminated fountain performances on, and that's going to run until September 30th. So you still have time for that. That's Thursday to Saturdays. It's included in their cost of admission. Under 4 is free. The shows are at 9:15 for a full half hour, and it's just a beautiful place to experience. And you still have some time to do that. You can go to longwoodgardens.org for more information about that. One of my favorite places. I was out there to see it, and it's just a great, great experience. They did a $90 million restoration, so there's all kinds of new seating areas, a grotto, a trestle bridge, and landscape paths, and it's just a great place to be and a great way to finish off the summer.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate your calling in. As always,
absolutely.
Tell us what's happening in Philadelphia. Appreciate
absolutely.
It. We'll talk to you next week. Donna Shore, you can go to visitphilly.com.
Sounds great, Tom.
Thank you so much.
Donna.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Bill, I want to finish up on the one question I had asked you, which is how do you help someone find the time to block out? If I come to you and I say, I want to do a sprint triathlon, it's my first triathlon, or I want to do a marathon. These are big commitments, and I've got a full-time job. What's the process that you go through with a potential client?
Well, what I'll do is, and that's one of the questions I ask them when they start a training program with me is how much time do you have to train? And I ask people to be realistic, because for me to design a training program for someone with an unrealistic time commitment, it's not going to work for anyone. They're going to get frustrated and, they're not going to be happy. They're not going to achieve the results that they want. So that's one of the important questions that I ask is how much time do you have to train? And then from there, when I'm designing their program, is I will build up to the maximum amount of time that they have, because I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make in their own training is that they have a tendency to sometimes do too much training or too much of their training too hard. So a lot of what people find when they start working with me is oftentimes I have them doing less training and training at lower intensities that they had done previously. And the whole idea is that they'll build up to their maximum amount of time, over a period of weeks and months. And in terms of improvement and being prepared for a specific goal or target race, that's going to be the appropriate way to do it. Because if you do too much too soon, oftentimes people end up getting injured or burnout mentally. So, part of my job is not only getting the athletes fit, but getting them so that they achieve their peak fitness at the time of the race and not a month or 2 months beforehand.
I think there's also been the advent of online coaching and things, and people tend to go the online route, or they'll get something from Runner's Magazine and they'll follow that program. But what are some of the mistakes you see athletes make if they try and do it on their own?
Well, I think, there's certainly a lot of resources out there, both free and paid resources online where you can get a training program. And in many instances, they may be fine for an athlete. They at least provide them with a template of what they should be doing. The downside and how what I do is different from those is that they're not individualized. They don't take into account how much time a particular individual may have to train. Doesn't take into account particular strengths and weaknesses an athlete may have. One athlete, may have never swam before, so they need to spend more time in their training doing swim workouts. So, the biggest downside of those online programs is that they don't take into account the particular characteristics of the individual.
Mitch, you've written articles and you've been interviewed and on podcasts and radio talking about mind chatter with athletes, which sounds maybe easy to understand, but it's not as easy as it sounds. What is mind chatter?
Well, I don't know how easy it is to understand, but athletes immediately get it when I describe that voice that can fill their head with doubt, second-guessing, and negative thinking. That shows up when you're in the sort of in the competition zone. It may not show up at a practice on Wednesday night. It might not show up when you're just hanging out at home watching Netflix. But when you start to get out of your comfort zone, when the race is approaching, when the event is near, our minds go into start talking to us, and it starts filling us with doubt, telling us why we can't do it, what could go wrong, what if this scenario, what if that scenario. And athletes immediately, when I talk to them about it, and I talk to practically every athlete about it, because they need to, in order to be as fast as you can be, as great as you can be as an athlete, you know how, you need to learn how to manage this mind chatter and this voice. So we go through a series of steps of first being able to identify it and name it as chatter, versus the athlete thinking that there's something wrong with them, that they're cowardly, that they're mentally weak. Instead, I try to get them to see that it's a normal part of the competition picture. And if they learn to kind of put mind chatter in its proper place and create some space for it, then they can begin to focus on why they're doing this race in the first place, because that's what happens. The chatter could suck all the fun out of what's supposed to be kind of a highlight of somebody's athletic career. So the chatter is that voice, Tom. The chatter is something we spend a lot of time talking about, learning how to manage it, the fact that it won't just go away. Olympic athletes, pro athletes, amateur athletes, junior athletes, everyone gets mind chatter. And that's true, as you said, not just in sports but in life when we kind of are out of our comfort zone. So I feel like that's probably the biggest lesson I can give to an athlete that could get them to show up at a race much more ready to go and actually – perform at a higher level because they now know how to manage the doubts.
Are there any tricks of the trade that people can employ? A couple of tricks of the trade?
Well, I think the instinct people have when the chatter comes is to try to get rid of it, to see it as something wrong. My trick is paradoxical. It's not about getting rid of it. It's actually about how to make room for it and make space for it. So I get mind chatter, and that does help because I've competed in these races that I can talk about. The chatter I felt standing, you know, by the water side before a race. So I know that someone's really onto it if they can get this idea that the chatter is supposed to come, it's part of the competition picture, and they could thank it for sharing, welcome it in, which sounds, again, something completely unexpected. But the more they can change their relationship to it by not fighting with it, that right there can free them up. And get them to refocus on something that's going to help them.
Yeah, I mean,
race.
Sometimes fighting it is not, you might think that's the easiest thing to do and just say, go away, go, you know, but instead of recognizing it, which may actually be easier than fighting it.
Yes, the more you resist, the more it persists, as I like to say, and the more you can let it be, the more it will let you be.
Is there a common type of mind chatter that certain athletes, do golfers always get the same type? Do runners always get the same type? Or is it totally different that everybody's mind chatter is specific to them?
I would say, there's certainly some specifics, but across the board, people don't want to be embarrassed. People don't want to not meet expectations, and they don't want to look bad.
High school athletes get different. Is that common?
I mean, that's across the board, yeah. Fundamentally. And so, because we worry about those things, as an athlete, then we worry about the result. Those are all results-focused things. Looking bad because I get a bad result. Being embarrassed because I get a bad result. Disappointing. Not meeting expectations. All those have to do with results. So I talk about why the more you focus on results, the more the chatter is going to come in. And so as a sports psych person, we try to help people focus more on the process, things that are under your control. The actual final result of a race, the final chip time you have, is not under your direct control. Otherwise, everybody would race exactly what they want to race and finish exactly when they
right,
want to finish.
Right.
But everyone gets that. Well, you can't always – you don't finish. You might want to finish in a half an hour. You're going to finish – below that, you might finish beyond that. So I really try to get people to get that you cannot control your actual result.
Right.
And once you kind of get that, so then you want to focus on some aspects of the race that are under your complete control.
Bill, as we wrap up, we have a couple minutes. Anything you want to talk to us, just let us know specifically what people can go to, how people can reach you, and what services specifically you can help them with.
Okay, well, people can find me at midatlanticmultisport.com. And in addition to the individualized coaching services that we talked about, designing training programs for individuals, training for particular events, whether it's a running race or a triathlon, we also offer the open water swim clinics and training swim opportunities throughout the spring and summer months. We still have one more coming up next week, so you can get information on that. And also offer a bunch of one-on-one sessions where we do swim analyses, running gait analyses, where we meet one-on-one with an athlete, get them in the pool or get them on the track. We videotape them in the water or running, help with their form or technique. So, but you can find all of it at midatlanticmultisport.com.
Midatlanticmultisport.com. How about you, Mitch? How can people get to you?
Yeah, my website has all the information about my practice and about the services we provide, both clinical services for those wanting more therapeutic help and those athletes out there who want some help getting ready for the next game or match. It's everything there.
Both excellent. And what's the website address?
www.greenpsych.com. G-R-E-E-N-E. Psych.com.
E on the end of green. Yep. Greenpsych.com, midatlanticmultisport.com. Guys, you've said it all. You've been here an hour. You've said it all. We've covered everything we had almost. We have plenty more to ask you, though, so hopefully you'll come back. Hopefully you'll come back again. Ryan, anything else to add? Anything compelling to add to the show before we leave?
When I think of open water swimming, I think of Rob Conrad. Did you guys remember the story of Rob Conrad a couple years ago? Football player. He fell in the water 10 miles out. He was out in Florida fishing.
Oh, right.
Yes. He fell 10 miles out of the boat. The boat capsized in the middle of the night, pitch dark. Swam 10 miles back to shore, covered in jelly stings because he wanted to come back to his kids.
Yes.
Crazy.
I do remember that.
Does anybody race? Don't they have long distance? I just read something on Facebook last night where they have, in Hawaii, it's like the rough water swim race or something like that. Open water, rough water, it said, though.
They do. They have distance swimming that has become more and more popular. I actually coached a college athlete this summer who swam. It's called the Eight Bridges Swim in New York, going back to New York.
Was that 25 miles or something?
Well, it was an 8-day swim. He did two legs of it. He swam 15 miles, and then 2 days later, he swam 18 miles in the Hudson River.
At one time or broken up over,
Two days apart.
Got in the water, swam 15 miles, got in the water, swam 18 miles.
Continuous 15 miles.
And didn't you coach someone who swam the English Channel this summer?
I did. I had a woman who swam as part of a relay across the English Channel, and she will be swimming it solo next summer.
And how far is that, the English Channel?
I think the swim itself is close to 30 miles. But what makes that tough, it's not so much the
sharks?
Distance. It's the cold temperature. I mean, it's really cold, rough water.
And so. Sharks. Sharks make it tough, too.
Sharks also.
They help you swim faster, though. Something when you have a great white shark chasing you, it makes you swim a little bit faster. All right, that's it for today. Appreciate everybody listening. We'll be back next Wednesday on WWDB 860 AM.